Sid Wells and the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay. Today we were going to have some speakers here from the Verizon strike, but they had to go back into negotiations, so we're going to hold that in abeyance for another week, and if the strike is still on, we'll talk with them directly, some of the bargaining committee folks there at Verizon. Okay, we wish them the best of luck. But we're going to talk about the Verizon strike a little bit. And I think you'd be amazed what's going on there. And then we're going to do our weekly review of the global economy, particularly looking at the IMF and some of its predictions here of where this global economy is going. What's happening in China, what's happening with banks in Italy, and what's happening, you know, in the Ukraine, once again, in Japan, the negative interest rates. There's no lack of interesting things developing here. But first, let's go back to talking about the topic right here at home. And that topic is the Verizon strike. We have 36,000 workers, members of the CWA, Communication Workers of America, and IBW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in the Northeast, are out on strike as of Wednesday. What are the issues here? Well, it's not money. No, it's jobs. The company wants to outsource, in other words, convert full-time, good-paying jobs as into independent contractors. In other words, throw them out of the bargaining unit and let other companies, independent contractors, pick them up. And, of course, as independent contractors, they're not going to get paid anywhere near what they were getting paid as employees, and probably virtually no benefits, because that's what happens when you contract out and get rid of jobs. So the issue is job security here. And this is a big issue that's plaguing American workers in general. We have these trends going on that are just devastating the American workforce, and they wonder why workers are so upset and, you know, going for Trump and going for Sanders here. You know, the elites of this country, they just can't figure that out. Well, it's not rocket science. People have been suffering now, certainly in the last 8 years since the crash, but it goes back structurally, fundamentally, even before that. American employers are changing the nature of jobs and work in this country, and workers are paying the cost. And I'm not just talking about the millions of jobs that have been sent overseas, manufacturing and professional services. I mean millions due to free trade and offshoring and tax cuts, tax provisions passed by Congress and presidents for the last 20 years that have encouraged and paid companies to send jobs offshore. I'm not talking just about that. I'm not talking just about 3 million jobs lost to China and 3 to 4 million jobs lost to NAFTA. I'm not talking just about that. I'm talking about the jobs that remained here, what's been happening to them, and what has that meant in terms of wages and incomes of the workforce? Look, there's 157 million people in the civilian labor force in this country. About 110 million of them are making $100,000 or less. Okay? And about, I think about 70 million or something, approximately 70, 78 million are hourly workers. So the working class in this country, 78 million are hourly paid, and maybe another 30 million are salary paid. This 108, 110 million, they're the folks who are paying the price. And there's been no recovery for them. In fact, it's been going backwards since 2008, a trend that began well before that. And they wonder why people are upset going for less mainstream left and right candidates here. Let's go back to the Verizon strike. Okay, and the company wanting to change the character of these jobs. When I say change, and for these $110 million, what I'm talking about is what's called alternative work arrangements, contingent jobs. Okay, what are contingent jobs? They are jobs that are part-time, jobs that are temporary. Temporary may be contract jobs and other kind of temp jobs. And jobs that are now going Uber, Uberization, right? We've been talking about that. We're going to continue talking about that. But let's even put the Uberization jobs aside, where workers, who are employed part-time or have no jobs, use their cars as cabs, right, as taxis, or go out and work for TaskRabbit, right, doing little odds and ends jobs here, or Airbnb, opening up their homes, to, I don't know what you would call them, kind of like bread and butter hotels, I don't know. But we got all these trends going on. Let's talk about them a little bit. What has this meant, this contingent job, alternative work arrangement? What has this meant for wages and job security in the country? Well, there's been a recent study by Princeton University and RAND Corporation, which talks about these trends, which have really accelerated in the last 10 years, but they've been going on since the Clinton years and even as far back as the Reagan years when we talk about temps and part-time, involuntary part-time developments, right? And why it's important is because the CEO of Verizon, this guy, what's his name? McGraw or something? I forget his name here. McAdam, CEO Lowell McAdam. You know, he puts on LinkedIn here a statement when the strike began that our objective in these negotiations is to preserve good jobs with competitive wages. Preserve good jobs, competitive wages. What a hypocrite, you know? What an outright lie. Because what he wants to do is take full-time, permanent jobs with benefits, contract them out, turn them into independent contractors, a form of contingent labor that's been booming in this country, where they will get maybe two-thirds of what they would get in wages and virtually no benefits. Well, that's preserving good jobs. They want to preserve jobs. That's with Verizon CEO. Yeah. What a lie. I'm going to tell you some figures here about what's happening with all this contingent job development, this Uberization, this contracting out and so forth of the jobs that are left in the U.S. Right? By the way, Verizon says it can't, it's got to remain competitive, so it's got to do this. Well, that's a crock of BS. Verizon spent in the last 2 years $140 billion buying other companies. $140 billion. See, Verizon has these two divisions, what's called the landline, the traditional division that's unionized with CWA and IBW workers, and it has the wireless division, which it has fought tooth and nail to keep unions out and unionization out of. A lot of its profits come from the wireless side. The wired side is very profitable, nonetheless, and there's great opportunities on the wired side with all this fiber optic stuff and the need to bring broadband to everybody in the country. So, you know, there's good opportunities there, but they're not investing there the way they should. They're investing in buying up other companies, right, and they're investing in the wireless side. You know, and they say, well, you know, we have to cut on the wired side. Well, it's one company, and it's profitable. That's like saying, if we were a Ford Motor Company, let's cut, the Focus, workers in the Focus brand of automobiles, and we'll keep the other brand of automobiles union, but let's deunionize just to focus. It's all one company, and it doesn't matter if the wireless is making profit or wireline's making less profit. It's all one company. They can afford to provide decent jobs. You see, big corporations in this country don't care anymore. They simply don't care about their workers having decent paying jobs. They are globally focused. And they're buying up each other all around the world. And, you know, it used to be 30, 40 years ago, workers had to make decent money in order to buy their products. Well, now, you know, their capital is global, and they're more interested in the Chinese or somebody else in South America buying their products than their American workers. So they're cutting the wages. And there's lots of ways of cutting wages. And the big way is to contract out or change full-time into part-time jobs and then don't pay any benefits, or hire temp workers, right, or Uberize them. You know, these are all these major trends going on in the American workforce, and they're really global trends as well of capitalism, not just in the U.S. Right? If you're interested in this, you know, chapter 13 of my book, Systemic Fragility and Global Economy, talks about these fundamental changes in the industrial structure and the labor markets and the exploitation that results in, classical exploitation, overlaid or underlying the financial exploitation that's been intensifying as well. Right? And I've been talking about this since 2005 in my book, The War at Home, about how all these changes have occurred and what it means in terms of exploitation. But let's get back to the Verizon strike here and talk about it in context of Verizon itself. Okay. What's the scope and magnitude of this, not just at Verizon, which is the latest example of this trend towards alternative jobs that's being created here for decades and intensifying, accelerating now. There's 157 million people in the civilian labor force in the United States, according to the Labor Department. And a recent study by Princeton University and RAND, as I mentioned, looking at full-time, just full-time contingent. In other words, full-time temporary workers, full-time contract workers, right? This study, which is based on the last 10 years from 2005 to 2015, indicated that there have been 9.4 million full-time contingent jobs that have been created. 9.4 million from 14.2 million in 2005 to 23.6 million. In 2015, as of November 2015. So 9.4 million of these contingent jobs. Contingent meaning almost always non-union, meaning temp, meaning contracted out jobs, right? Individual contractors, and temporary work, right? Full-time, but temporary and contract. 9.4 million of these jobs have been created. What it reflects is companies getting rid of full-time permanent in-house employees and throwing them out to individual contractors. Right, 9.4 million. And of course, they get paid a lot less on these non-union contract jobs. Now, it's interesting that this study contrasts this 9.4 million of these full-time contingent jobs created with the fact in the last 10 years we've totally created 9.1 million jobs. So you could easily argue that all these jobs being created are contingent, full-time contingent jobs, temps and contractors at lower pay. Right? Now, you got to add on top of this, the study doesn't look at contingent part-time jobs. By definition, part-time jobs are contingent. Right, and there's 26 million of those jobs Okay, 23.6 million of full-time contingent, 26 million of part-time contingent. You've got almost 50 million jobs that are contingent, alternative, meaning lower pay, virtually no benefits. In fact, some of them don't even get paid holidays, let alone vacations or sick leave or anything. 50 million people. 50 million people out of 157 million people in this country are stuck in these contingent part-time, contingent full-time jobs with lower pay, lower benefits. This is a phenomenon since the Clinton era, especially. Now, you got to add on top of that 50 million another unemployed 8 million, according to the U3 unemployment rate, which looks at just full-time unemployed, another 8 million. So you got 52 million contingent jobs, and you got 8 million. You got 60 million people in this country today either making nothing or making part-time, temp, contingent, lower-paid, no-benefits work. 60 million. It's amazing, isn't it? That many people. Well, you wonder why there's no wage, real wage growth going on? This is it. This is it. When you read the newspaper, by the way, and, oh, wages were up 3% this year, right? That's only full-time jobs. That's not part-time jobs. That's not contingent jobs. That's full-time. Those are the workers who still are left in full-time permanent work. That doesn't include all the part-time. Doesn't include the contingent. Right? If you factored all that in, wages are going down. Median wages are going down in this country and since 2008. Yeah, big recovery, Barack. Big recovery for folks. Yeah. Your investors have recovered. We know that. Your corporations have recovered. You know, but the rest have not recovered. And no wonder they're upset. Okay, here's some facts from the Bureau of Labor Statistics on median weekly earnings. Median weekly earnings. How this job, radical job transformation in this country is translated into substandard pay. All right, median weekly earnings. Median's what's important. And weekly earnings are your hourly pay times the hours that you work, or if you get a salary, it's just your salary pay. Right, median weekly earnings of full-time workers, right, full-time, $809 a week. That's $42,000 a year. Median weekly earnings, $42,000 a year. You try living on that in a major city in the United States with a family, right? And that's the median. In other words, half of the people are making less than that, and another half are making more than that. You know, in economics, you always want to look at a median indicator, which gives you a better sense of the truth. Right? Not averages. Averages factor in the big pay of the people at the very top, including CEOs, their salaries, and so forth. You know, never look at average pay, average salaries, and try to look at hourly pay because, you know, the guys at the top, the CEOs, don't get paid by the hour. They get paid salaries, you know, and the very, very high end, the managers and entry level managers and others are way above. So averages distort, but medians don't distort. And median pay for full time workers, $809. A week, $42,000 a year. All right, so what's the median weekly earnings of the 26 million part-time workers in this country? $246 a week, or $12,800 a year. Way below the poverty. We got 26 million people are way below the poverty level. $12,800. You know, a poverty level for a family of four is about twice that. In the low 20s, okay? If you averaged out the median for part-time and full-time, it would be $627 a week. $627. So you're looking at maybe $30,000. I don't know, 52 weeks times $620,000, about $30,000. We've got, that's not counting the people who are on unemployment benefits and unemployed, that other 8.2 million. You know, let's even, that would lower it even more, but let's put that out. You know, let's just say 50 million people contingent on various kinds, full-time, part-time, contingent, you know. 50 million people averaging $30,000 a year. $30,000, not much, right? And it's not growing. In fact, it's shrinking 1% to 2% per year, right? Well, no wonder you got 60 million people making nothing or peanuts going backwards. No wonder folks are upset. Come on. Oh, but the New York Times won't be telling you all about this. No, no, or certainly not the Wall Street Journal. You know, they'll just report the average salaries or something like that. Most of the youth, 16 to 24, are in the category of this part-time contingent. In other words, they're only working part-time. And, you know, they're making the $246 a week if they got a job, right? It's the 25 to 54 and the 55 to 74 years ranges are part of this, reflected in this Princeton RAND study, right? They're full-time, but they're contingent. They're contractors. Contract jobs are temp jobs of various kinds, non-contract, temp, agency temp, or independent contractor temp. Well, these are this is what the McAdam and Verizon management want to throw thousands of their union workers onto this heap, this poor paid job heap that we got growing in this country. And you know, like I said at the beginning, I'm not even counting. They don't even know how many people are stuck in Uber jobs. You know, where you get paid by the piecemeal, how many people you carry around in your car and wear your car out and use your cash to buy your gas and pay your insurance, right? That's what Uber is. Talk about super exploitation. Uber is super exploitation. And that trend is spreading rapidly everywhere. You know, that's the next crisis on top of this contingent part-time contract development, right? By the way, 32% of everybody in the labor force is holding some kind of multiple job. Multiple. In other words, they can't make ends meet on $246 a week, so they work two $246 a week. You know, a lot of people who are working custodians, working in hotels for the hotel workers, you know, aligned with the hotel workers union, they work that job in order to get union benefits, and then they got to work another job for non-union somewhere, you know. By the way, Uberization is beginning to penetrate that sector as well. It's a disease. It's a cancer. It's spreading everywhere. On top of all these contract jobs we created, on top of all this part-time jobs we created, and temp jobs. And this is all super exploitation, meaning management, the companies, get to keep more of the revenue created by those workers. And workers get less, and they get more and more. They're inventing new business models, you know, like Uber, where they keep more and more for themselves. They're not satisfied anymore just with offshoring the good jobs, you know, 10 million offshored. They're not satisfied with that. The jobs that remain, they're squeezing that, squeezing everything they can out of it, and taking more and more for themselves and leaving less and less for workers. No wonder people are upset. Right? Well, as you listen to you know, this event with Verizon strike. This is a challenge. This is a worker union challenge to this major trend going on. The workers will never, and their unions will never be able to really prevent it and roll it back, taking it on one industry, one strike at a time. This has to be a real unified political effort. There's no way to stop this by industrial action. You might be able to slow it down. You might be able to maybe stall it for a while, you know. But it's going to continue. The pressure on these labor market radical changes going on in the U.S. labor market, driven by employers, finding new ways to squeeze more and more profit out of their workers, that's going to continue. But this Verizon strike is the front lines right now of this struggle against this trend. And what you'll read is, contracting out, creating contractors with jobs, which is the number one issue in this strike, by the way. It's job security. It's keeping decent jobs. It's not wages for those who have the decent jobs. The union's not asking for big wage increases, and they have an agreement, and as I understand it, with the company on wages, right? Well, they don't have agreement is throwing people on this independent contractor rubbish heap, unfortunately. All right, so that's the what I think is the number one news here of the week, and we should watch that, and we'll come back hopefully next week if the strike is still on. We'll talk with some of the heads of the local unions on the bargaining committee there in CWA and IBW, right there, you know, ground zero, New York City, right? And Verizon, you know, from Boston, New England, down to the mid-Atlantic states, as they call them. this struggle going on, very important, historic struggle. It's not just another union fight over management, over a few more pennies. No, this is the future of the American workforce and American workers. Can we stop this thing? Can we reverse this thing? You know, the politicians talk about raising minimum wage, and that's okay, you know, but that affects several million workers. But we're talking about, you know, the core, the rest of the working class and the workforce in this country. We're talking about, you know, the middle class, if you want to talk about it in those terms. It's really, you know, the decently paid, once decently paid working class, which is being hollowed out here, both by free trade, which is coming, more of that nonsense is coming, and then on top of that, you know, all the offshoring and subsidization with our taxes of moving jobs offshore. Free trade, they're both related to each other, and you know, they've cost about 10 million jobs since Bill Clinton here. Thank him for pushing free trade, and thank Barack Obama for accelerating free trade, the biggest free trader in the last 40 years, Barack Obama. And the only one seemingly opposed to free trade and offshoring is Bernie Sanders. Now, so far, well, we've got even on the right, we've got Donald Trump acknowledging it and getting a lot of interest. You know, they're going after Trump. The Republican establishment will never let him be the candidate. They're going after him because, you know, he doesn't act like quite like the normal Republican. You know, he's against free trade. You know, he's for protecting Social Security and Medicare, and he's talking about fair taxation. You know, that's a weird Republican. And yeah, he's kind of wild with some of his statements. You know, trying to be provocative to get coverage. That's his strategy, you know, rather than taking money from other multimillionaires and billionaires, you know, like Cruz, who's crawls on his knees to his big Texas right-wing billionaire friends. So he's funding his stuff. Trump isn't funding that, right? I don't know about this Trump guy. You know, maybe he's just lying to us. Maybe he's just pandering to everybody. That could be the case, too, because I don't trust politicians. They all lie through their teeth, tell you what they think they want you that you want to hear, and then they go and do what they want anyway. Okay, that could be the case with Trump. But, you know, Trump is appealing to working-class voters because he's taking stands that are typically un-Republican. You know, yeah, he's xenophobic here on this immigration thing. Makes him very unappealing. But, you know, I don't quite feel the same way, presuming he's not lying through his teeth, that some intellectuals do. You know, they're all offended by certain things, but they're not looking behind the scenes what's really driving this Trump phenomenon, and it's his appeal to the working class, really. White working class, granted, okay? And it's reactionary in some ways, but you got to understand really what he's appealing to. I'm not advocating Trump, don't get me wrong, but I am acknowledging the fact that he's got his thumb on this great discontent. So does Bernie Sanders, in a more progressive way, of course. Yes, he's got his thumb on it, too. Trump is appealing to the middle-aged white working class, right? Sanders is appealing to the youth, 30 and under, working class, and not just white, because most of those who are being hurt the most are people of color in the working class. Right, so Sanders is tapping into that, and we may have a very interesting year, election year here. We could have a four-candidate race here, because if we assume, on the one hand, that Trump will never be allowed to get the nomination, in the Republicans, they will find some way of doing it, of preventing him. Especially if he doesn't get the necessary minimum delegates, they will prevent him. You know, look, the elites run the conventions, both the Democratic and Republican Party conventions, and they can change rules on the fly. You know, all these conventions have rules committees. They have credentials committees. And that's how they can maneuver and ensure they get the candidate they want. You know, it's very undemocratic, both parties, the way they operate, right? I mean, just look at the Democratic Party and this gimmick here of superdelegates, right? That's a way of ensuring the party hacks will have overwhelming influence to reverse a nomination if they want, you know? And what would they do with Sanders? You know, they'll never let Sanders get the nomination either. You know, the Rules Committee could simply say, look, you know, Sanders has been an independent. He's not in the Democratic Party. Therefore, he can't get the nomination. Something like that. It's very easy. You know, if you've been in a lot of union conventions, you know how those games are played with the Rules Committee and credentials committees. And they can maneuver and get the outcome, whatever they want, basically. Right? So they'll never let Sanders get the nomination. And the Republicans, I don't believe, well, there's a slight chance still, will not let Trump get the nomination. Trump, if he doesn't get the nomination, will run as an independent, I predict. Sanders should, if he doesn't. He's already committed he would support Hillary, but he should break that pledge because, you know, the country's at a historic juncture here, right? He's never going to be able to run again since 74, I believe now, 73-74, right? And the Democratic Party elites will never allow someone like Sanders, to run in their nomination process again. They got a real scare of their life with Bernie, and I predict they'll never allow that happen again. They thought that he would not get as much support as he has, that he could just be used to keep the progressive left wing of the party committed to their centrist right candidate, which is Hillary, right? That's what they thought. But he surprised them. Surprised them because they did not understand, elites in both parties, the depth of the discontent that exists out there in the U.S., out in the grassroots, particularly among the 110 million working class folks out there who have been left behind, as I've described. And you know, they've ignored that. And when they've got a little sense that, oh, there's discontent out there, okay, so they start tweaking with the minimum wage. You know, they thought that would be enough. Well, it's not enough. Not enough. The middle, the big middle of the working class is discontent. There's been no solution offered by mainstream candidates for their discontent. No solution whatsoever. Just more of the same, you see. And that great core of the American working class senses that. And what we've got is the beginning, the very beginning of the politicization of the working class, meaning they will do things independently themselves, which has got to happen. They're still doing it within the context of the two-party system, but as conditions develop, they may break with that two-party system, and that's what has to happen. So we may see a four-way race here if certainly Trump will run as an independent. Sanders should, and less likely he will. But that means he will undermine his own legacy and his own historical obligation here. But let's assume if he does, we could have a four-way race. You see, this election is quite different than any we've had in many years here. Because of what's going on in the working class, moving left and right, we could see, if we had four candidates, someone could win the presidency with 30% of the electoral votes. That could happen. You know, Trump split on the Republican side, split the electoral votes on the Republican side, and he certainly would, and Sanders split on the Democratic side. I mean, look, Sanders should run because where is he strong? He's strong in the North and the West. North, Northeast, right, Great Lakes, and the West. This is where he's been winning, not in the South. Well, he could get 30% of electoral votes in those key states. It's conceivable if he ran. Hillary would get the South, much more conservative and in her pocket, and a few other states here and there. That could happen. Sanders could actually get more electoral votes than Hillary could. Right. And on the Republican side, Trump, you know, would probably also get much of the South, except for Texas, right, and some of the other areas, other states, you know, which we'll see, certainly New York and so forth. He could get, you know, a quarter of the electoral votes, and the establishment Republican candidate could get the rest. Now, who would be the establishment Republican candidate if he ran, right? Well, you think it would be Cruz? No, I don't think Cruz could win an election for dog catcher if it were a national election here, right? It'll be somebody else at a brokered Republican convention. Recently, some talk has been of Paul Ryan being the candidate, you know, the unity candidate here. That's quite possible, I think. You know, Ryan said no, you know, but that doesn't mean anything because he said no. He just went on a big tour, a global tour, to, you know, be able to say, I have some foreign policy credentials here. You know, I visited all these countries and so on and so forth. And you know, the other indicator that it might be Ryan is that the money is flowing into Ryan. The big money is now flowing, you know, that used to go to Jeb Bush and Rubio is now going into Ryan. That's a sign, I think, that they're preparing something. The Republican elites are preparing something. I don't think it's actually been decided that they would not support Trump. They still might, but I think it's quite possible they would support someone else like a Ryan, some independent candidate. Right. It wouldn't be Cruz if they were trying to stop Trump. It wouldn't be Cruz. It would be somebody else. All right. So that's my take of the election scenario here, and the Verizon strike, and the class politics that are behind a lot of this, and what's happening to the American working class, which is just tragic here. Okay, so let's talk now about also what's going on in the global economy and what time we have left here. Okay, well, this past week, very clearly, the IMF, International Monetary Fund, came out with its financial stability report warning once again that this global economy is increasingly fragile. Fragile is the word that they used. You know, well, that's the title of my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, right? Well, what does that mean? What does it mean, a fragile global economy? Well, it means the economy, the global economy, is slowing down. The real economy, clearly, is slowing down, right? Or what they say, this slowdown is the new mediocre. This is the IMF's words here, Jose Vinales, right? Who I think is like a vice president of the IMF or something, you know, this latest stability report that came out with earlier in this week. As it says, a quote from the Financial Times, the global financial system, you know, is maybe more resilient than it used to be, but it's still in trouble, right? Still in trouble. It's not 2008, okay, but it is a big problem here. Corporate debt in China is $1.3 trillion owned by companies that don't earn enough money to make payments on the interest on that debt, right? $1.3 trillion, 14% of China's total corporate debt, which is huge, right, can't be paid right now. Whoa, wait a minute, that's a problem, I would say. Hmm? And we've got other concerns, right, by the IMF in terms of its forecast, slowing again. You know, the IMF for 5 years now has issued these semi-annual forecasts of the global economy, and for 5 years they've had to continually downgrade, estimate their previous predictions. They're always over-predicting, and they're always lowering their forecast. So if that continues, we can expect even slower growth in the global economy than the IMF is forecasting, right? It lowered its forecast for 2016 recently here this past week to only 3.2%, right? So, and everywhere, things are slowing down. Well, you know, China just issued its first quarter GDP, 6.8% or 6.7%. But, you know, those China numbers are really not very reliable, and everybody knows it, right? And everybody knows that India's GDP is about half of what they say it is, right? All over the world, these governments have been tweaking their GDP numbers to try to keep them up. I've talked about that before, and we won't go there again. But GDP forecasts here, you know, Japan is in recession again, going negative. Brazil is in a basket case, you know, a GDP drop estimating this year of maybe 5% GDP contraction. Germany, you know, UK and so forth are barely 1%. And we're going to see, interestingly, and I may talk about that next week or the week after, my prediction that the U.S. economy here for the first quarter of this year may be stagnant, virtually flat, you know, as I predicted it would several times several months ago. And this would be like the fourth time or fifth time that the U.S. economy flattened out, and usually in the winter quarter flattens out, right, since 2008. Fourth or fifth time that we've gotten virtually zero growth. I think it was 2014 or 15, we collapsed to zero growth. And then they adjust it and they say, well, it's a little bit above zero growth, right? That way they don't have to say we slipped into a recession, right? But keep in mind, about $500 billion of whatever that GDP is, or about 0.3%, is just definitional changes to GDP that were made in 2013. You know, based on intellectual property and all that stuff that you can't really estimate, but they put a number on it, nonetheless. And what was cost are now additions to GDP and investment for corporations. So, you know, the U.S. has been tweaking it in a more sophisticated way than Nigeria or India or even some European countries where prostitution estimates and drug smuggling estimates are added to GDP numbers over there. So, you know, it's very indicating here this past week, to sum up, IMF is forecasting a downturn, slowdown in the global economy, continuing slowdown. Oh, and we have a little bit of rise in oil prices awaiting this conference being held in the Middle East, where some of the OPEC economies have gotten together out of desperation to try to stem the decline of oil prices here. And oil, as a result, has risen a little bit up into the low 40s, price of a barrel of oil globally. In anticipation, speculators are raising the price a little bit. But we'll see whether that produces anything, because there are major, major parts of the global oil economy that aren't participating in this. You know, the Russians are, the Middle East is, and you know, some of Venezuela and others are trying to put a floor on the collapse of oil. But we'll see whether that works. Iran's not participating. The U.S. isn't participating. Neither is Canada or Mexico, right? And the U.S. produces almost 10 million barrels a day out of this, you know. So we'll see. Well, maybe that's not 10 million a day, excuse me. I think that's 10 million a year. So in any event, you know, there's big gaps in this effort, and I predict they're not going to be successful, and you're going to see a resumption of a decline in oil prices here in a couple more weeks, right? And then, of course, we have in Europe this big fear about Britain exiting the European Union, and that's a touch-and-go thing. Boy, they're pulling out all the stops to convince the British voters to stay in the EU. We'll see how that works. A lot depends on how bad the British economy slows down, which it is, between now and June 23rd and that vote. And whether they could keep out of the press and sort of contain the impact of all this immigration, refugees flowing into Europe because of the disruption of the Middle East caused by Europe and the U.S. military adventures. Okay, so we'll see. And the IMF have also warned about the Brexit, as they call it, British exit from the EU. You know, I think it's kind of touch and go. It depends what happens between now and then, because I think British, you know, average British workers are realizing that there's not that much to gain for them in all this. This was another deal by the elites to benefit themselves. And, well, we'll see what happens here. We'll watch that closely, because if Britain does exit the EU, it's going to cause great disruption in global currencies, and it's going to have a major impact on slowing the European economy, which is already stagnant. You know, there's already indications that, you know, Germany industrial production is slowing down, and so forth. In the midst of all this, we have growing indications everywhere of banks being in trouble, bad loans by banks. You know, the ground zero for that are the Italian banks right now. But there's, you know, kind of signs that bad bank, bad loans in China are massive. In India, bad banks and bad loans are increasingly getting attention. In Japan, this whole negative interest rate thing is now becoming clear. It's been a disaster. Not only hasn't done anything positive for investment and job creation in Japan, but it's actually done the opposite in Japan. Japan is the worst basket case anywhere globally right now in advanced economies. And all this monetary, extreme monetary policy experimentation, you know, QEs and negative rates and so forth, is not having any effect on even stimulating any more Japanese financial asset markets, you know, stock and bond markets. It's not even doing that anymore. And as the U.S. And Europe, clearly, in the U.S., decision not to raise interest rates has a negative impact on Japan and a negative impact on Europe, in the sense that currencies, the U.S. currency does not continue to rise, and that means that all the QEs that Europe has done and Japan has done are negated by U.S. policy to keep the dollar from rising by keeping interest rates low. Why is the U.S. the Federal Reserve doing that? Well, it's really to protect U.S. multinational corporations' revenue and profit in emerging markets where they're heavily engaged. Because if the U.S. raises interest rates, the value of the dollar goes up, and if the dollar goes up, then the currencies in these other countries where the U.S. multinationals are playing in emerging markets, the currencies collapse, go down in those emerging markets, and therefore has a major impact on the balance sheets and profit statements of U.S. multinational corporations doing businesses there. So this idea of the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates low and not raise them is really, really targeting U.S. multinational corporations and trying to minimize the impact of the negative profit and revenue implications in emerging markets, you see, where they're doing all this business. It really hits them hard, U.S. multinationals, hits them hard when emerging market currencies collapse, and they collapse when the dollar rises. You see, it's all relative when you talk about currencies and currency wars. So the Fed is really not looking at the domestic U.S. economy. The Fed is really looking at U.S. multinational corporations and how to help them by keeping interest rates low. Because, you know, keeping interest rates as low as it has now for 8 years has had a devastating effect on household incomes, particularly for retirees, on fixed incomes. You know, there's been no earnings at all from the money in their savings accounts for 8 years. And we're talking about trillions of dollars that would have been earned by average retired and even non-retired U.S. working class households. I mean, the fact that interest rates are zero and there's been no interest income generated for 50 million people in the U.S. at least, you know, is the flip side of low interest rates stimulating financial stocks and bonds speculation and the rich benefiting from that. And as I just said, the multinational corporations benefiting offshore in emerging markets from that. The Fed is taking care of investors and speculators and multinationals at the direct expense of households in the U.S. It's almost as if you got an income transfer from people on fixed incomes, who can afford it the least, to the speculators, to the stock speculators, the bond speculators, to the multinational corporations. The Fed is serving their interests. And people are becoming more and more aware, by the way, that the Federal Reserve is doing that, right? It's not about, It's not about keeping low interest rates so we can generate jobs in the economy and so forth. Well, that's the textbook explanation. You know, we've had near zero interest rates in the country for 8 years. It hasn't stimulated real investment and real job creation in the U.S. at all for 8 years. And it's resulted in this massive transfer of income from fixed income households to financial markets. And that was the intention from the very beginning of the Fed. The whole idea was to make the rich richer and hope that they would trickle down some money here and invest and create jobs in the U.S. Well, we certainly made them richer, but we didn't even get a trickle down. All that financial speculation and financial profits went offshore, or they went sitting on balance sheets of corporations, or they went into stock buybacks and raising debt, corporate debt bonds to buy back stock. You know, that was a big trend. $5 trillion of that has occurred. So it's all about subsidizing financial elites. That's what the Fed's been doing, subsidizing the financial elites and U.S. corporations and big investors. And that's why you got this huge income inequality going on. You know, I mean, we talked at the beginning of the show how, you know, median weekly earnings going nowhere because of all this radical transformation of labor markets and work and the structure of work in this country. And then, people on fixed incomes, you know, making nothing, going backwards in real terms themselves. You know, those retired going backwards because of Fed policy. Those who are working going backwards because of all these radical changes in the labor markets and labor structure in the U.S., right? If you don't own a lot of capital, you know, you've been paying the price. But if you own capital, you've been in fat city. Fat city. Things have been going great. And they still are. And the Fed's taking care of you still. You know, if you're a multinational corporation and an investor, taking care of you. And that's a big problem. You know, who does the Federal Reserve really represent? Does it represent the country? No. In the very beginning, the Fed was created in 1913 with the specific purpose of bailing out the banks that crashed in 1907-8. And the banks couldn't bail themselves out. The U.S. Treasury had to put up almost all the money to bail out the banks, prevent another depression in 1907, the big depression in the 1890s and 1870s, 1830s in this country. Almost had one in 1907-8, right? The Treasury bails out the banks, and the economy stagnates until World War I, right? Well, the Fed was created to bail out the banks. And that's its primary function. And we're going to be talking about that more. I have a new book coming out at the end of the year just on that. All right, next week we're hoping to talk to the Verizon strikers here. And we'll do our follow-up on the global economy. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.